Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. 2 weeks from tomorrow, President-elect Donald Trump will become President Trump. As he ascends to the nation's highest office, the media is doing a lot of navel-gazing. Why did the press fail to predict his win? Is the media elitist, as many Trump supporters contend? And how should journalists deal with the rise of fake news? With us to discuss such questions is writer and cultural critic Lee Siegel. He's the winner of a National Magazine Award for Reviews and Criticism and a regular contributor to the Columbia Journalism Review, where he's written numerous articles about media in the age of Trump. He joins us from a studio at Montclair State University in New Jersey. Welcome to On the Record.
Nice to be here.
What's the one thing the media should have done differently in covering the election?
Well, the one problem that the media has is that it really does live in this kind of pampered, privileged bubble. Everything changed in the media under Reagan, who created incredible prosperity for media organizations and the upper half of society. And in the 1980s, that's when journalists started making big bucks, which they never had before, especially print journalists. And they began to turn inward. And you had publications like the New York Observer, which were centered on reporting simply on the media. And you had the media thinking about the media, and it began to occupy its own plane of reality. The media talks to each other, and people belong to the same clubs, and they go to the same parties, and they marry the same people, and they went to the same schools, and they all have the right, correct, liberal view of reality. And it's very hard to allow into this reality anything strange or bizarre. Most of life is strange and bizarre.
So is the media elitist, as Trump supporters contend?
It's elitist in the sense that it occupies a privileged position. On the other hand, being hard-pressed and deprived is no guarantee of objectivity, truthfulness, or compassion either. And I think for a while after the election, Trump supporters were treated with kid gloves and began to occupy their own elite space. You couldn't criticize people who seemed to vote for Trump out of socioeconomic pain and displacement. So the media is elitist in the sense that it occupies this privileged place, and yes, it is out of touch with ordinary experience. But at the same time, I don't see how you could be part of that class of people who makes sense of life without occupying an elite space, because to make sense of life, you need a certain kind of freedom that's guaranteed or enabled by material means, and you need peace and quiet, and you can't be knocked about by the forces that buffet people who are written about. So to be reflective is by its very nature elite, but that doesn't necessarily mean that your point of view is compromised.
What if I substituted the word smug and ask you, is the media smug?
Some of the media is smug. Anthony Bourdain just went after Bill Maher for being the very pinnacle of smugness. I think a lot of the privilege does tip over into smugness. I think there are certain columnists, whose names I won't mention, who don't seem to be able to write a line about conservatives, Republicans, without being sardonic and ironic. I think when you've been around people who share your point of view for so long, you take a certain perspective for granted and you end up being smug. Yes, absolutely.
This is On the Record on WIP. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with media critic Lee Siegel, a regular contributor to the Columbia Journalism Review, along with a host of other publications. We're talking about the press in the age of Trump. While I continue to let the balanced view you shared about whether the media is elitist and whether that's a bad thing, while I let that percolate through my head, let me go back to the first question, which you didn't exactly answer. What's the one thing the media should have done differently? If it's elitism itself is not a sin, which seemed to be what you were saying.
I would like to see a greater economic diversity of people in the media, not just a diversity of identity. I would like to see more and more people coming from, you know, not from the Ivy League schools, people coming from ordinary places in America. I think that might guarantee a different perspective. But mostly I'd like the media to become owned by philanthropists like Jeff Bezos. I'd like the media to stop being a business. And I think the fact that the media has become a business and a sinking business had a lot to do with the election of Trump.
Explain that.
Well, when The Apprentice came on the air, I watched it and I was horrified that this phrase, you're fired, and that the humiliation of people looking for jobs was touted by the liberal media who covered it obsessively as this wonderful show and this revelation of Trump's brilliance as a financier. There was some laughing up their sleeve at him, but nevertheless, they bought into his whole shtick because they wanted a corner of his demographic. And the press has done that again and again and again. I recently wrote something about Stewart and Colbert being pioneers of fake news, and people just went nuts. But in fact, I wasn't begrudging them their value. I was on Stewart's show, and he was very generous to me, and I enjoyed being there. I live behind Stephen Colbert. I like him a lot and have a lot of respect for those guys. But just as Fox News was purveying fake news, so were these guys. But the liberal media quoted them as if they were a pair of senators because they wanted part of their demographic.
Let me interrupt and bore into that a little bit, Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert of Comedy Central. Comedians have always made fun of politics and politicians. Walk us through why you're pointing a finger at them as something different.
Well, there's a difference between Mort Saul saying that liberals believe that they deserve everything that they have and conservatives believe that they deserve everything they've stolen. That's a joke. It happens within the framework of a joke. There's a difference between that and Colbert sitting before a House subcommittee on farming and immigration as a legitimate witness. There's a difference between political satire, say the political satire of the Smothers Brothers. If you remember, their show was censored by CBS and finally canceled because of all their satirical attacks on the Nixon administration. There's a difference between satire, which is clearly satire, and the political rally that Stewart and Colbert held in Washington, which tens of thousands of people attended, not knowing whether it was political or not. It was there that you suddenly had this irrevocable blending and fusion of politics and entertainment that had been going on for a long time. And who, if not Donald Trump, is the perfect product of the fusion of politics and entertainment? Without The Apprentice, he would be nothing. Never would have been elected to the presidency. And people may complain about fake news now, but when it was being purveyed by our guys, then it was okay.
I'm having trouble following you there because it seems to me that even the rally on the Mall that you're talking about, even certainly when Colbert set up the whole pack and walked us through with the lawyer what was involved in hiding the identity of donors to a political action committee, etc., with all of that, it seemed to me there was a frame around it that said, look what we're doing. This is not reality, which is different than fake news stories popping up in your Facebook feed.
Well, listen, I hate fake news and I hate what has happened to our country. But don't you think there's a frame around a lot of those outlandish Breitbart stories? Don't you think there's a frame around, I don't even know how to pronounce his name, Milo Yiannopoulos's routine where he's winking at the audience? We don't want to concede that to the other side, but they have the same thing. But when they do it, it's evil. When we do it, it's good. I don't want to dump on Stewart and Colbert. I don't think that they're the reason we have Donald Trump. They were sources of catharsis. They exposed a lot of the bullshit. And I, like everyone else, was grateful for that. But what I'm saying is that there was a moment when politics and entertainment, because of the commercial bang of those two things, fused. Trump was elected by half the country, but he was created by the whole country. And he was created by a bottomless, insatiable, all-consuming commercial culture. And we are basically all part of that, and the media especially.
Before we leave the topic, how dangerous do you think fake news is?
You know, I just saw a very interesting movie called Denial about Deborah Lipstadt and David Irving, the Holocaust denier. There's a great similarity between denying the Holocaust and fake news. At the same time, there has always been propaganda. There has always been misinformation, disinformation, and gossip. I think we notice it now because it's part of the constellation around Trump. But I don't think it's as much of a problem as people think it is. I think the problem goes much deeper. The problem has partly been created by the web, which was itself created by commerce. The problem is emotion over reason, opinion over taking a rational presentation of the facts. I think it's not just fake news, it's a cultural style where emotion, whether it's on your Twitter feed, whatever your social media thing is, emotion becomes the sort of primary gratification that people are seeking when they read the news.
Okay, we need to take a quick break here on The Record. I'm Sheila Cast. When we come back, more from cultural and media critic and Columbia Journalism Review contributor Lee Siegel. I want to ask why he thinks the press failed to see the level of support for Donald Trump. This is On The Record on WIPR. Stay with us. Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking today about the press in the era of Trump. My guest is writer and cultural critic Lee Siegel. He's the author of 6 books, winner of a National Magazine Award, and a regular contributor to the Columbia Journalism Review. Why do you think the press failed to see how much support Donald Trump had?
Because Trump is crazy. I don't think it was so much a blindness to all the pain out there and all the confusion and disorientation and everything else that was creating support for Trump. I think it was just an assumption that that part of the country, no matter how desperate, no matter how irrational, no matter how alienated, would not vote for someone who was clearly mentally unstable.
A writer in The Atlantic used the phrase, I'm doing this from memory, that many of Trump's supporters didn't take him literally, but took him seriously, whereas the press in general took him literally, but not seriously.
Well, that's a bunch of sophistic crap, and that was written by Peter Thiel, who is one of Trump's supporters. I don't even know what that means.
Well, I'm just wondering whether you agree that the press did not take Donald Trump seriously as they were covering him during the primaries.
How can you take seriously someone who's bonkers? You know, why take him seriously? He's an entertainer. He's a clown. He's a bankrupt. He's a flimflam man. He's a fraud. He's an unsuccessful businessman who's been fooling people for decades. How can you blame serious people for not taking him seriously?
You have no problem with the press having used its regular forms and frames of journalism in reporting his tweets, etc., until all of a sudden, sort of at the time of the conventions, the press kind of lurched to a different position where many publications called him a liar about one point or another. The New York Times went from the more conventional way of saying there's no evidence for that or this conflicts with what he said earlier to saying he lied.
Well, I think that throughout Republican primaries, the press was reporting on his falsehoods. They might not have used the word lie, but they made it clear that he was lying. And then afterwards, some press organizations decided to use that word. Others didn't. I know Jerry Baker, the editor of the Journal, said that they're still not going to use the word lie. To me, that's all semantics. They were sticking to the convention of objectivity in the press, and then suddenly Trump changed all the rules when he became the party nominee. But I don't blame the press for trying to maintain the dignity of the institution.
Do you blame the press for then changing those rules and using words like lie, which they had not up to that point?
No, they were adapting. That's what the press did, and that's what they should have done, and that's what the press will have to keep doing as it covers this guy. I mean, on the one hand, the press should not give in to hysterical scenarios of fascist takeover and all of this. On the other hand, the press simply has to do what it has always done, but do it better than ever before, which is to ferret out the truth.
A few days after the election, you wrote, quote, "What I wouldn't give to be a journalist in my 20s or 30s just starting out at this moment," end quote. Why?
It's exciting now. Everything's changing. This guy has thrown open the windows in some ways and let the light in. He has exposed the limitations of our institutions. He has exposed the fact that we are living in an age where our institutions and cultural forms have not caught up with where society and politics and economics are. And to be a young journalist now and to try to make sense of all that through reporting, through opining, through commentary, analysis, I think it's thrilling.
I mean, a lot of journalists are feeling demoralized, not to mention despised right now. Do you really think we're entering a golden era for journalism?
Why do they feel despised?
Because the president-elect often holds them up to ridicule. And his supporters sometimes confront them and yell at them and threaten them.
Isn't that the price you pay for telling the truth? Why should journalists be liked by anyone? Their job is to burst the bubbles of privilege and power and to break shibboleths and to shatter platitudes and conventional ways of perception. Why should a journalist expect not to be despised? What's wrong with that?
You hang around with journalists, as I do sometimes. That has not been the expectation up till now. Perhaps it should be.
The expectation is that you'll get invited to a dinner with Obama, and you'll be tamed by him and completely assimilated by him, and you'll get close to power, and you'll have all the glamour of that, and you'll go to all the fancy parties after the White House Correspondents' Dinner. To me, that's scarier in some ways than what you have now. What you have now is the way it should be. Power is not nice. Power is not your friend. You have to be suspicious of it. You have to hold it to account. You have to hold Trump's feet now and all the people around him to the fire in a way that people never did with Obama. I see it as a wonderful opportunity for journalism to reinvent itself.
Let me pick up on that. You have written that if the media had held President Obama's feet to the fire more rigorously early in his tenure as president, that we'd be in a better position now. Talk about that.
Well, he was elected after 8 years of Bush, after 8 years of a war that wasted this country humanly and socially and economically. The country was completely demoralized. It was on its knees. He had both houses of Congress. He could have done what he wanted to do. Instead, people show up at the town halls with AK-47s, town halls on health care, and he retreats. And it's 18 months from his inauguration, 18 months before he comes to the Oval Office and addresses the nation. That was after the BP oil crisis. Whereas he should have been doing that from the very beginning. And if journalists had pushed him to do that, and they didn't, everyone was all caught up celebrating their own virtue by expressing jubilation over the election of the first black president. If journalists, instead of celebrating their own virtue in that way, had pushed him, had held his feet to the fire, when he had both houses of Congress, before the Republicans began their long campaign of obstructionism, then maybe things would be different.
And do you think the mainstream media has a liberal bias?
If you define liberalism as an ideology that looks to the future and seeks to adapt to the present, and that in itself is skeptical of concentrations of power, I think by its nature the media is liberal. Yes, and I think that's okay, so long as the media is honest about it and so long as they stick to the evidence and use reason and logic instead of emotion. Sure, why not?
There has been a lot of talk in media circles lately about resisting the urge to normalize Donald Trump, but you write that the real danger lies in mystifying him. How so?
Yeah, well, the media now is so embarrassed about projecting the impression of having been blind to him that they've gone to the other extreme, some people in the media. Trump has been compared to ancient Roman tyrants, Hitler, Mussolini, Putin, Pinochet, Perón, Chavez. It's too much. It's hysterical and it's self-dramatizing, and it mystifies him. It turns him into a menacing enigma. Someone in some publication wrote an article. The headline was that he's making an enemies list. The article didn't have any proof that he was making an enemies list. So it's turning him into this very frightening figure, which will have the effect of intimidating people and maybe cowing people when it comes to telling the truth about him. And I don't think that's healthy.
How can the press regain the public's trust?
Well, that's a complicated question. The press didn't lose the public's trust to the extent that it has all by itself. That's been going on for a long time, since the advent of television and then the internet and then the change in the economic structure of the country. And by the press turning itself into a form of diversion, people have turned to other diversions. How can the press gain the public's trust? Simply by continuing to do what it does, to keep telling the truth. I think what's bedeviling the press is really the platforms and the means of delivery, and also this, culture in which people are driven further into themselves and seek out the most intense stimulations and gratifications. When you talk about the press having to change, the readership has to change too. There are changes in the culture that make changes in the press almost irrelevant, if you know what I mean.
I'm reminded of Barney Frank once saying about politics that voters are no day at the beach either.
Well, and that's so true. I'm reminded of a more sinister thing, the famous poem by Brecht, where a hostile government says, let's dissolve the people and elect a new one.
You at one point said journalism should be a philanthropy, not a business.
Right, right. Well, I'd like to get into that. You know, journalism had its heyday during the Vietnam War, right? You know, and then Watergate and all the President's Men and all that stuff. And that's when journalists became heroes. Until that point, journalism had not always been objective. Look at all these old movies about journalists, Ace in the Hole, Nothing Sacred, The Front Page. Journalists are all portrayed as cynical, sensationalizing hustlers. It wasn't until the 70s that journalists became heroes. So journalism changed, but the business of journalism remained the same. It remained a business. And I think that it has to stop being a business. It really should be a philanthropy. And as I said, look at the effect that's had on the Washington Post.
If journalism were a philanthropy, not a business, who would actually support it? And would that not make journalism even more a tool of the elites?
Well, again, you have bad elites, you have good elites. I don't have a problem with good elites. I don't have a problem with the Marshall Project, for example, which seems to have support all along the ideological spectrum for reforming prisons and criminal justice. I don't have a problem with whoever is supporting ProPublica, and I don't have a problem with the Washington Post. So it all depends on who the elites are and what their agenda is. If they're good, fine. If they're bad, well, yeah, that's a problem.
But there is a form of democracy involved in a journalism that has to respond to readers and viewers, has to respond to clicks. It responds to something beyond a few wealthy donors.
It responds to the commercial appetite of advertisers and subscribers. I don't see why that's any better. If you have an enlightened philanthropist supporting your institution, and he or she has a conscience, or at least knows enough to leave the practice of the news to an editor with great instincts, decency, rationality, and conscience, I think that's far less commercial and commercially compromising than depending on clicks and advertisers and the shifting appetites of a vast unknown audience. You know, that's why I have such an admiration for Bezos's Washington Post. He bought it. It's been freed from the compromises of being a business, and it can just go out there and tell the truth, and it's been really great about pursuing Trump, and it's picked up subscribers and readers and everything. And I think that that's a shining example of what the press could become and could keep doing.
Thank you for all these thoughts. I appreciate the conversation.
Me too.
Writer and media critic Lee Siegel. We have links to his articles for the Columbia Journalism Review at the On the Record page at wypr.org. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cass. Glad you've been with us. Tune in again tomorrow.